time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, good morning. And
morning, Bob.
We'll begin with, well, it used to be called the Mayor Daily Marathon, right?
Who knew? Are you running it this year, Bob?
I like to watch because I see people at the finish line collapsing and being thrown into ambulances. So I've never been big on that.
They just look, I mean, I'm so grateful that I've been cheering them on for years, but you're right. Never done it myself. But 47 years ago, Bob, 1977, the Chicago Marathon launched, and it was known as the Mayor Daley Marathon. The year before, Mayor Daley had suddenly died of a heart attack, and they named it in his honor. That first year, Bob, only 4,000 runners participated. Now we have more than 10 times that, which is interesting. And also interesting to note, that very first year, 1977, the city park commissioner, Ed Kelly, and a number of people in the city were like, we don't want this thing going through our city. We don't want them trampling on our lawns and our grass and our green space and have to clean up. We don't want any of this. The lakefront, he was banning all of it from being used. But eventually, Mayor Blendick, who took over for Daley, was a runner himself, convinced him to allow it. So went on the first one and just became more popular after that. Interestingly, though, if you go way back to 1905, there were other marathons that were held in sporadic years here in the city. First one at Evanston Golf Club in 1905. Then the runners were known to take shots of whiskey during the race.
Not Gatorade.
No. There were no Gatorade back then. And then they sip champagne, the sophisticated ones. There are stories of that in the Chicago Tribune. High-performance running shoes, Bob, they didn't exist back then. So the newspaper reports are of, like, their feet would be bleeding at the finish line, back to your earlier point. So things have changed a lot. And now the most elite runners in the world come here. It is one of the flattest and fastest courses in the world. And lots of world records set here, including last year. We pulled a little piece from the WGN-TV story about Kelvin Kiptum last year.
Kiptum shattered the world record by more than half a minute, running 26.2 miles in just 2 hours and 35 seconds.
I think he was emotionally spent.
The new world record holder leapt into Pinkowski's open arms.
It was something that just happened. He just kind of relaxed, and I held him up, and I said, you're the world record holder now. You brought this record back to Chicago.
And now you have runners from all over the world coming here, don't you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It is one of the marathons that they all want to participate in. And October 13th is going to be the date for this year.
Mm-hmm.
Two Sundays.
Bank of America Chicago Marathon. Mm-hmm. Now we talk about Charles Wacker.
Okay, so we know Wacker Drive, but do you know Charles Wacker? I mean, honestly.
No.
We don't know who this person is.
But I bet he had two levels to him.
He was a multifaceted leveled person, that's for sure. And he had a lot of great ideas. A pivotal person in the history of Chicago, no doubt about it. We've all heard Daniel Burnham's name. This was someone who was on the same page as Daniel Burnham, a close friend by his side, a fierce advocate for green space, urban planning that thought of citizens first, and a huge proponent of keeping the lakefront free and clear. Charles Wacker was originally a beer brewer in the city, a successful one at that. He became head of the city planning commission and then noticed that this road along the river, this major artery into the city, the downtown area, was so congested, and it was total chaos as Chicago's population exploded, Bob. This artery was just, you had commercial traffic, you had horse-drawn carriages at one point interacting with automobiles and streetcars and pedestrian traffic, delivery trucks and boats along the river pulling up and unloading their stuff. So Charles Wacker said, let's make a multi-level road with purpose. And the upper level was designed for general traffic, people coming and going, like commuters, I guess you could say. And then the lower level was designed for the commercial traffic, deliveries and garbage trucks and vehicles carrying stuff back and forth into the loop area. And over time, of course, it would become the famous shortcut for locals and cab drivers and Hollywood's favorite spot to film car chases.
Genius, genius idea.
Yeah, think about it. And back then, so revolutionary, had not been done in other cities, and became sort of a shining example of how Chicago was figuring stuff out when it came to urban planning.
Thank you, Charles Wacker.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jeannie Gang, for making our city one of the great architectural wonders of the world.
Gosh, such a history in Chicago of architecture, and she is the modern day answer that just so grateful for her. This week, 2011, Jeannie Gang was awarded the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grant in Architecture. The Belvedere High School grad went to U of I, graduated with a degree in architecture, and was on the cusp of just just taking the architecture world by storm. Within a few short years of that genius grant, she was named to Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential Women in the Country. She designed the Aqua Building, then the tallest building designed by a woman, went on to the Vista Tower right over here. We can see it, the St. Regis Building on the lakefront, now the tallest building designed by a woman. And she had this unique approach to architecture where she used modern design that interacted with the nature around it. So like the Aqua Building reflects the waves of the water of Lake Michigan that it overlooks. Kind of an interesting concept that is studied all around the world. Her designs, also sustainability and environmentally conscious is part of who she is. Here, we pulled a little pic, snippet here from a TED Talk Jeannie Gang did a few years back.
I'm a relationship builder. When you think of relationship builder, don't you just automatically think architect? Probably not. That's because most people think architects design buildings and cities, but what we really design are relationships. Because cities are about people. They're places where people come together for all kinds of exchange. And besides skylines, they're highly specific urban habitats with their own insects, plants, and animals, and even their own weather. For me, the field of ecology has provided important insight. Because ecologists don't just look at individual species on their own, they look at the relationships between living things and their environment. They look at how all the diverse parts of the ecosystem are interconnected, and it's actually this balance, this web of life that sustains life. My team and I have been applying insights from ecology to architecture to see how physical space can help build stronger relationships.
So creative. We had her on the show here a while back, and going into the interview, I felt intimidated, but boy, she puts people right at ease, so friendly and unassuming.
Yeah, no, I feel the same. It just, she's amazing, pretty incredible.
This has been one of my favorites for a long time, 1979, Smashing Pumpkins, and this week in 88 was a big one for them, wasn't it, Anna?
Very first concert, Bob, for the band. It was at Cabaret Metro, right on Clark Street in Wrigleyville this week, 1988. Full circle moment, by the way, for Billy Corgan, who grew up in Chicago, went to many, many concerts at the Metro, really heavily influenced by bands there, idolized a lot of them, and it was his dream to play there. True story, Billy Corgan would try to corner Metro owner Joe Shanahan in the lobby after concerts or catch him somewhere and hand him cassette tapes and say, listen to my music. Don't I belong on the stage at the Metro? Shanahan still has those cassette tapes. And he finally agreed to let the Smashing Pumpkins perform in October 1988, then a totally unknown local band. And here is a clip we pulled from Joe Shanahan about then.
One of my close friends in the music industry, or in our, I prefer maybe to say music community, is Billy Corgan, and he still talks about that story about how, you know, when he got to Chicago, he lived here in Wrigleyville and went to baseball games at Wrigley Field and wanted to play at Metro, and that was what he felt would be his success when he got a gig at Metro. Of course, great things have happened for him. He's an example of someone who's always come back, performed here, you know, either put a local support band on one of his shows. It's called giving back. I think musicians in general remember. At one time, I was that kid handing a CD or a tape to Joe Shanahan in the lobby of Metro.
Joe Shanahan has been a great force for music in the Chicago community.
Discovered so many bands, yeah, mm-hmm. And just cool to hear that story.
And let's see, now we have some history about the Jewels.
The Jewels. You know, I looked into it for you, Bob. I could not find the anniversary of when it officially became the Jewels, but I do have another anniversary to talk about. 1899, Frank Ross formed the Jewel Tea Company, Jewel. It was known by that name 125 years ago. That's why we're seeing all the Jewel stores across town now wrapped in that commemorative paper celebrating that anniversary. Started as a door-to-door tea and coffee delivery service, a horse-drawn carriage that would bring your tea, your coffee right to your door, and just established this great, loyal customer service base, based loyalty from people across Chicago. It was one of the first to pivot into being a true grocery store that would offer a variety of goods. And within a few years, they built a huge facility in Barrington. And then the grocery stores just took off to become one of the most popular anywhere in the country 125 years ago. Do we have time for the little clip from, no, let's skip that because it's, we want to make sure we get to the last one. But again, no record that I could find, Bob, of when it officially became known as the Jewels. I'm going to the Jewels to get mayonnaise for the potato salad. Okay, yeah, I'll be right back, Ma.
Oh, and people say the Jewelasco now, too, don't they?
They do.
Finally, we have, well, this is such a great piece of Chicago history. Tell us about the Walnut Room.
Walnut Room opened in 1906, a very first formal restaurant inside a department store in the United States, located famously on the 7th floor of the Grand Marshall Fields store on State Street. At the time, Fields was one of the most prestigious stores in the country, and or maybe the world. And this was a concept of offering shoppers, mainly women, an elegant dining experience to break up their day and to keep them in the store. Let's face it, men had the downtown athletic and social clubs. Now women had the 7th floor of Fields, originally called the South Tea Room. It became known for its rich walnut paneling. And there you go, became renamed the Walnut Room. Holiday time, such a huge deal that, you know, I'm sure listeners right now, there are generations of families who would go and take pictures in front of the giant tree and just dine at the Walnut Room as part of their holiday tradition. It was a huge concern, Bob, when Macy's took over that would not be preserved, and give them credit, they did. By the way, I went on Open Table, which is they're already taking bookings for Christmas time.
Already?
There are very few left.
No,
I was
kidding.
Literally trying to book for this December, and go figure, it is very tough to get a reservation right now.
Did you bring us some Frango mint chocolate cream pie or cheesecake?
Just reading that, they released the menu. Can you believe it? The chocolate, the Frango mint cheesecake and the Frango mint chocolate cream pie. That's enough to get you there this year.
Yeah, and of course, they still have the famous chicken pot pie, don't they?
Yeah, that was Mrs. Herring, who was a clerk at the store and designed it to also keep the husbands fed while they were paying for all the dresses and things like that. So she kept people in the store. Still offered to this day, and not bad prices, actually. I was even looking, you know, for a holiday festive tradition kind of thing. I was looking at the prices. You know, I think that's $16 for the chicken pot pie.
All right, I'll see if I can book for my family for 2025.
Yeah, 26. You might be able to get in.
All
yeah,
started
sure.
in 1907, This Week in Chicago History. The Walnut Room. Thanks, Anna.
Of course.
See you next Wednesday.
See you then.